Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, your beginner's guide to obstetric anaesthetics. I'm Owen, I'm one of the co-hosts, I'm an anaesthetic registrar working in Thames Valley, and with me as always is Rosie. Together we are joined by Serena Sidhu, who will be asking us everything that she wants to know about the common conditions she will be encountering perioperatively on labour ward. This podcast is brought to you in association with the Royal College of Anaesthetists and the Obstetric Anaesthetists Association. And as ever, the views and opinions that are expressed by myself and the others on this podcast are that of our own. I would have really wanted this episode when I was starting out in the world of obstetric anaesthetics to try to work out what exactly do I need to know about PET and how can these conditions present to me anaesthetically and what will I need to do. Hopefully we'll answer all of these questions. We do go into a little bit of complexity when discussing some of these cases, especially one of the placenta cases that Rosie mentioned. These aren't necessarily cases that you'll be dealing with alone as a novice, but it's good for us to demonstrate the complexity and MDT level decision making that is required in obstetrics. As ever, I hope you really enjoy the episode and please do like and share it with friends. Hello and welcome back to the NovPod, a beginner's guide to the world of obstetric anaesthetics. I think we're now on to episode 4, a bit about maternal pathophysiology, where we'll be dealing with some old conditions, some new conditions, with a obstetric anaesthetic twist. I'm one of your co-hosts, I'm Owen Dorr, I'm an anaesthetic reg in Thames Valley, and with me today is my other co-host.
Hi, I'm Rosie. I'm an anaesthetic reg in South East London, currently about to depart from the country.
Passport in hand, cocktail in hand as well. And we're very delighted to be joined by a obstetric novice, Serena Sidhu.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me back.
Welcome.
I am delighted to have you back in one way. I'm not delighted to have you back because you're going to be quizzing us about maternal pathophysiology. I've had to read some big words in some big word books to make myself sound clever, so hopefully we'll make it a bit less confusing for you, although that might be the rosy part. I might just add to the confusion.
Won't be the first time, Owen.
Won't be the first time. Serena and I work together on calls, so I think she's used to that clear communication. The key to today for this episode is that if we were to tell you about every maternal condition, we A, wouldn't be able to release it because it would be too long, and B, you would be asleep by the time we got halfway through. The important bit for this is to think about trying to get you towards is not just the condition, but it's a generalised approach, and also using this as a platform to go off and read about these conditions so that the first time you're encountering them is not when you're leading onto your obstetric on call, for example.
Yeah, I don't want to be furiously Googling around an emergency on labour ward, so this sounds good.
And when we set you the set list off for today, a bit of the run list and the things we were going to come up, were there any dreaded sweats or were there some where you looked at and you're like, I'm not even sure what we're going to cover with this?
A confusing amount of conditions that involve the word placenta.
Yeah.
So much placenta.
I think even now I'm probably starting to have nightmares about maternal hemorrhages. It just sounds like a very stressful thing.
We love a guideline.
Although someone did say that guidelines like sausages, like everyone loves them, but you'd hate if you know what went into them.
On the topic of guidelines, we should plug the Obstetric Quick Reference Handbook, which has got a lot of emergency management, one of which is maternal hemorrhage, which is quite helpful. Keeping that on your phone somewhere handy.
Covers quite a general basic approach in some areas, and it covers some really good niche topics in others. There are some good BJA articles that we'll link to. There are some very good e-learning for health things. Does that all sound exciting?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're excited for today?
I'm still awake.
So for today, because we'll be going through a bit of pathophysiology, we've tried to bring it alive to you. Okay, so Serena, you're the on-call anaesthetist in the tertiary obstetrics unit, despite having done 0 days of obstetric anaesthetics, which seems just about right.
Yeah.
Me and Rosie have gone for a cup of tea, so we're leaving you on the obstetric wards, and there's just a couple of patients that we've asked you to go and review, and me and Rosie might help you before we go for our cup of tea. Does that sound all right?
Yeah.
Sounds about right for our night shifts together, doesn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm agreeing to, really, but
standard.
Fantastic. So what's the first patient on the board saying?
Okay, room 3, BMI 50, hypertension, diabetes, G1, P0.
How nervous does that make you?
BMI sounds quite high. I'm not entirely clear what G and P mean, and I don't know how well controlled the diabetes and blood pressure are either. So, yeah, not straightforward.
Rosie, why is there a G and a P? Is it go and is it pass, or what's it mean?
Collect £200. This is a big topic, OBS acronyms, and obviously you'll come to terms with however things are normally documented in your area. But gravida and parity. So gravida is how many times that person's been pregnant. So if it's G0, this person hasn't been pregnant before. And they're often referred to as primips. So this is this person's first pregnancy. And then parity refers to how many babies have been delivered past 24 weeks. Those could be either stillbirths or live births. Mm. If it's gravida 2, para 1, then you can think that this patient is pregnant with their second baby, and you'd want to know how that first baby was delivered and what the outcome of that was. This is a person in their first pregnancy.
There's an element of simplicity, but a lot of comorbidities.
The unknown.
Why is it important, the fact that her BMI is so high? How does that affect me?
That's a good question. Why are they writing on that board? They don't like wasting in this world of sustainability any pen marker or having to do. And they want to reduce as many actions as possible. But there are a few things that you need to be aware of with it, and that's things for the maternal mother in terms of her comorbidities. There are things associated with the fetus, and then there are things associated with obstetric and anaesthetic interventions that we'll be doing. For the mother, she's more likely to be hypertensive. She's more likely to be diabetic, as you've seen on the board that's been written by someone. She is more likely to be associated with respiratory conditions, including obstructive sleep apnea. She can suffer with increased risk of clots in the lungs or legs, and therefore might be on prophylactic low molecular weight heparin. And then we've got to think about the fetus. They're more likely to be born prem with congenital abnormalities, and they're more likely to suffer from intrauterine death. And for our anaesthetic interventions, we need to know that the airway is going to be more difficult. I know probably the first point to go to, classic anaesthetist. Mm-hmm. We've got more likely that they're going to have cardiopulmonary dysfunction that will affect our anaesthetic delivery, and they're more associated with increased perioperative morbidity and mortality. From our obstetric colleagues, we know that they are more likely to appear in theatre or be intervened with during their anaesthetic care. So you've got someone with more comorbidities who has worse fetal outcomes, who maybe, and there are other anaesthetic factors that can be more difficult, such as regional citation and things like that, which we'll get onto in a sec, and the intervention rate is higher. So I think you've got someone who is a person you are going to want to assess early and know what your plan would be for an epidural, for IV access, for theatre, for example. So it makes sense. So that's sort of why that's on the board, is to flag that up.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot to consider with her. So there's a lot of physiological changes that happen in pregnancy. Is there anything extra or different that happens in patients with obesity?
Great question. I will confer to the notes that I've written in front of me, which is lovely. I think firstly, because it's a spectrum of how obese people are, right? So obesity can be classed in a system by the WHO classification in 1, 2 or 3. 1 above 30, 2 above 35, 3 above 40. So this woman's in class 3, so she's already at the higher risk element of the impact on her physiology. In the second episode, we went over some of the physiological changes. So what are the additional ones you were asking me? What a great way to not answer a question. That's why I passed my Viva so quickly. Airway wise, they're more likely to suffer with OSA. However, due to the fact that they have an increase in sensitivity to PaCO2, actually their symptoms can improve. And they also start to sleep on their side after, I think, about 20 weeks. So you might actually have hidden OSA, which may signify that they could be more difficult to ventilate, right? Respiratory-wise, they end up with a decrease in their lung volumes and a decrease in their compliance, okay? And that's very basically, as the uterus grows, it shoves the diaphragm up and makes it more difficult for those lungs to expand under the same pressure. There's VQ mismatching, and they're known to have a lower PaO2 and a higher PaCO2 in comparison to non-obese pregnant mothers. In terms of cardiovascular, they end up with a higher heart rate in terms of general. There's quite a few cardiovascular changes, and they can end up with left ventricular hypertrophy due to an increase in afterload that they're having to contract against. And with the OSA, you can end up with right ventricular changes as well. There's a very significant thing to be aware of, which is that the aorta caval compression, which is when you have such a large uterus, when you lie on your back, it squashes down the IVC. And especially under spinal anaesthetic, when you get rid of people's sympathetic homeostasis to respond to that, you can have people lose their output quite quickly. Think bigger stomach, bigger uterus, bigger aortic caval compression, okay? Mm. They also are known to have an increased incidence of hiatus hernia and diabetes. So we're looking at someone from airway to gastro that is associated with more changes going on.
There are some guidelines that women who are of a higher BMI should have been referred to anaesthetic clinic, and these mm-hmm. things should have been discussed and these risks highlighted to them already. But obviously you're encountering them on labour ward, mm-hmm. so you would want to have a look for that documentation and try and see what the plan was at the time and then go and have a conversation about it. The Society of Bariatric Anaesthesia have got some really nice guidelines on anaesthetic consent for people and how to have those conversations sensitively without perpetuating stigma or causing anxiety or distress to people. So that's a really good resource to have a look at as well.
They would be seen in a high-risk clinic, and that information would be available to you as to what they would propose should happen to help everything proceed safely.
They're likely to have been seen in the high risk.
One would hope. Okay.
Maybe your first thing to do is trawl through all the notes and see whether or not that has or hasn't happened. I've had quite a few times that I've had people appear without a high risk review. Then it initiates you to go through those systems that we've mentioned, have a look at those comorbidities and have a think about how you're going to deal with them, and also communicate with them what their plan or preferences would be for various different things.
Okay, so going back to our patient in room 3, we've recognised that she's high risk, so we want to be proactive about this. So I've come and told you and stopped you from having your cup of tea.
That's really, that MSF's not getting filled out now.
And my question is, what on earth do I need to do to make sure that this doesn't end in a disaster?
First is the thing we mentioned about MDT decision making. I'd want to know what their plans are, whether or not they're going to induce or this is going to be a cesarean section. I'd like to see you have a look at a note, see what the anaesthetic high risk plan was and whether or not she has been seen or whether or not I need to go and set some expectations. And then I would have a look, check for the other comorbidities that I've mentioned there. So that's the assessment of the lady. I would send you to make sure we've got the correct equipment available, including things like beds, hover mattresses, make sure we've got the Oxford pillow ready in case we need it. And then I would go and assess this lady early just to see if there's any changes, assess her airway, do a full anaesthetic assessment, make sure we've got good IV access, and due to that increased risk of bleeding, I'd get a good group and save. I'd consider an early epidural for the reasons of the fact that epidurals are more difficult to fill the midline. You can be longer than 8 centimetres until your epidural space. It's difficult to get into the position. And so for that reason, I use an ultrasound when I do an epidural. That doesn't cover everything to do with that high risk assessment. It's the early assessment of airway, making sure that she's on board for the fact that you may have to change your anaesthetic technique. I'd also work out early on what the plan would be if they needed to do a general anaesthetic. Is it someone, maybe not this lady, that I'd be happy to do on my own? Or is it someone I need to wait for senior support? And that's something to speak to your consultant about early, what they'd want to do, and then relay that information to the obstetric team and to the woman as well. Also to note for myself, when I'm seeing her or when I'm performing epidural in that room, her fetal monitoring is going to be a lot harder. So they either do it via a monitor that's on the central abdomen, but it's harder to pick up. So they might do a fetal scalp electrode. That baby needs to be monitored. So if they're not picking it up, that's the first priority if I'm inserting an epidural.
Logical steps of how to break it down.
Now I'm going for my cup of tea, right?
Well, no. I think she might have started contracting. And so actually, no, before you go for that cup of tea, the midwife just come and grabbed me and said that they've got reduced fetal movements and they want to do a CAT too.
So I think there's a couple of things to notice here. Firstly, I would make sure that someone's going to drink that cup of tea that I've just made, because otherwise that'll be a disaster.
Priority number one.
You could give it to the patient.
Definitely not. Making sure that we've got the correct drugs, equipment, monitoring and personnel for this person. There are some specific things to notice. One is that with regional, it's more technically difficult to cite, and also it goes up quicker if you think that pressure in the epidural space caused by pressure in the abdominal cavities pushing onto the epidural veins. And these people are at risk of limited respiratory compensation if they're flat on their chest due to that chest wall compliance issue with having more tissue there. So you need to make sure they are positioned correctly with Oxford pillows ideally. Secondly, as I've mentioned, is that aorta caval compression is going to be higher for them, so they're going to need to be off tilted quicker. They also, GA wise, up to 33% difficult laryngoscopy. So prepare yourself, video laryngoscope, make sure they've been pre-oxygenated because they're going to desaturate quicker. And then think about the other themes that we talk about. So bleeding, you're going to need to know what your uterotonics tonics are going to be. When you're going to bring in TXA, you need to be sharper to losses of blood because they could be more concealed.
And you're definitely not going for that cup of tea. Did you already explain why they're at increased risk of bleeding?
There's lots of reasons why they're at increased risk of bleeding. It's got a lot to do with combination of uterine tone and the fact that they're more difficult surgery, so there can be more trauma associated with it as well. Sense. Higher risk of comorbidities, which all come with increased risk of bleeding as well.
Makes sense.
So general anaesthetic concerns would be that they've got more of a difficult airway. Their abdominal compartment can push the breast tissue upwards, which makes it more difficult then to place a laryngoscope in. That's obesity. I think there's some important post-op things to think about. These are people who are more likely to get C-section complications, such as dehiscence and infection. They're people who are more likely to have pain issues, and they're also at higher risk of clots, so you need to be hot with the correct dosing of VTE. And recovery-wise, a more vulnerable respiratory system, so make sure you leave them at 30 degrees and that they have the correct oxygen and that they are early mobilised to open up the bottom of their lungs and reduce that VTE risk as well. So that's obesity is a bit of a snapshot.
To summarise some key takeaways from what you've told me. Once I'm happy with epidurals, considering getting savvy with ultrasound to help with this patient population.
I really think that helps your first pass, yeah.
Make sure they've got good IV access and group and saves. Is that the case with obstetric patients in general?
I think very much the case in obstetrics when you've got more difficult IV access and you know there are a higher risk of bleeding. Yes, it's important in maternity, but when you're reviewing that patient who's BMI 50, look at what it is, look what colour it is, and that is definitely someone I would consider just putting one in yourself so it's there.
Yeah, or two.
Or two.
And then I guess one of your key messages was just as soon as you hear about this patient, be thinking about a net potential airway plan and who you need around and how you're going to get that.
Plan for everything and discuss it with them and know what you would do at each stage. And early epidurals are something that I've recommended in my practice, and I'm looking forward to the people coming at me on Twitter about it. But I think it's better to cite them when you've got someone who is of much more increased technical difficulty, and we've got evidence that regional anaesthesia in these patients decreases their morbidity and mortality. I think it's a good idea. Lovely. Does that make sense? Are you now less scared, more scared?
Feel more informed, too.
Fantastic. So sorry for both boring you and terrifying you as well at the same time in some weird
yin-yang
tandem about obesity. I'm now going to go off for the cup of tea, but there's now a second patient to see after we've dealt with the lady with the BMI 50. So can you go and see them?
At one point, we might let you have a cup of tea.
That would be nice.
No. Tea's not for juniors.
I like coffee instead. Okay, so roommate, 38-year-old lady, Gravida 4, Para 3. It says that she's had multiple previous sections and it says placenta previa in the next box. What is that?
There are lots of different placenta issues, which I think used to confuse me when I first started OBS. Be a lot of different language and different terminology. So placenta previa is more about where it's lying, and placenta accreta spectrum is more about how far through it's going. But if one's abnormal, be suspicious of the other.
Okay.
Placenta previa is where the placenta is inserted into the lower uterine segment, either very close to or covering the internal loss of the cervix. And as you can imagine, if that cervix starts to dilate and they go into spontaneous labour, there can be a lot of bleeding. And that's often how they might have presented antenatally as well. Maybe they've seen the placenta is low on the scans. Maybe they've presented with painless vaginal bleeding. There are four grades, which just differ depending on how close the placenta is and how much it's covering the os, with one being the mildest and four being the most severe. But these ladies will often be delivered via cesarean section, so you might see placenta previa pop up on your elective section list as a comorbidity or an indication for C-section. And the main concern that we have for them is that there is a much higher risk of bleeding, and there's also an association with the other types of abnormal placentas, which are part of the placenta accreta spectrum.
We're saying that there's placenta previa.
Yeah.
But then they might also have a degree of accreta.
So when they've looked at the placenta accreta spectrum cases, when they've looked at their imaging, there's an 80% association with placenta previa.
Okay. Accreta. What is that?
Placenta accreta spectrum, or PAS, is where we're talking about the placenta abnormally invading into the body. There are three of those. So there's placenta accreta, I know, placenta increta, and placenta percreta. I love a bit of Latin. So placenta accreta is where the placental villi are adherent to the myometrium, and that makes up the vast majority, so 75% of PAS. Then one step further than that, you've got placenta increta, which is where the placenta has invaded the myometrium, and that's about 20%.
I like what you did there.
I know. And then placenta percreta, which is the most severe, where the placenta's gone all the way through the myometrium to the serosa and sometimes to the surrounding organs, so bladder involvement and things like that. And that's around 7%. So thankfully, that's the least common one, but it's also the most serious. And the reason why we worry about this is because they can bleed a lot. And the reason why it happens is because you've got a sort of area of previous uterine scar, which means that the placenta fails that decidualization phase and then it invades into the myometrium. And so you can imagine, if you think about the risk factors, anything that's involved instrumentation or scarring of the uterus, including things like previous C-sections, myomectomies, multiple hysteroscopies, etc., increase that risk. And then there are other things like advanced maternal age, IVF, etc. There's lots of different risk factors. What we want is for these women to be picked up early and managed in a specialist centre that has experience in dealing with placenta previa or placenta accreta spectrum, because we want MDT input, we want to prevent them from bleeding, we want to time the delivery to make sure that they don't start a process of spontaneous labour or have like an emergency section in the middle of the night, for example. In the rest of OBS, we try and control things as much as possible, but obviously some of these will present unrecognised in centres that don't manage this normally, so it's important for everyone to kind of be aware of the guidelines and how we would manage them. A lot of terminology. Does it make sense?
Yes, I think so. A lot of placenta somethings, but I get the gist of it. What implications does that have for us in terms of managing these ladies on labour ward?
Thinking about the timing is one of the main things, so you're trying to balance fetal maturity with delivery and preventing the woman from going into spontaneous labour. And your main role in the pre-op side of things would be planning with the MDT. What is everybody going to do? Where are you going to deliver in terms of location? So some places will, if it's a straightforward placenta previa, it may be that this woman is on the elective C-section list and you just prepare for bleeding. If it's one of the placenta accreta spectrum disorders, this would be an MDT discussion with the surgical specialties who might need to be involved. So you have obstetrics, but you might also have urologists, for example. You might be thinking about going to interventional radiology. That's another specialty that can be involved. And you might be thinking about what the plan is in terms of the surgical approach. The ones that I've seen, for example, the lady came into theatre initially, had a CSE put in and had ureteric stents placed to protect the ureters, then went down to interventional radiology to have balloons put in to stem the arterial blood supply to the uterus, and then had the baby delivered.
Wow.
I know. You're
like a case report. Yeah. This is not the normal.
This is not IOCOA, but then had the baby delivered. All of those things are to prevent lots of bleeding. And often they won't actually try and remove the placenta. There will be a plan for a hysterectomy, or there will be a plan to leave the placenta in situ. So your management is slightly different. Intraoperatively, again, a decision between neuraxial anaesthesia and general anaesthesia. Both have got their pros and cons beyond the scope of all of this, but there's some very good BJA articles about it. The general principles of prevention of bleeding in OBS apply. So large bore IV access, keeping them warm, preventing acidosis, knowing what's in your pack one and pack two. So your maternal obstetric hemorrhage guidelines are really important. And this is somebody who you would expect to have blood products cross-matched for already. But it might be a case of just making sure that you've discussed that with the patient. What are their preferences? Are they happy for you to use cell salvage? Have you got a haematologist involved? All in that team brief, you should have lots of people there talking about what all the different contingency plans are.
Sounds good, but quite complicated at the same time. So in terms of maternal obstetric hemorrhage, is there any differences in the way that you'd manage an MOH in these patients versus other obstetric patients?
In terms of maternal obstetric hemorrhage, if we're just thinking generally, we always think about our four T's in massive obstetric hemorrhage. So tone, so uterine atony, which is by far the most common one that we would encounter in theatre, for example. Trauma, which is from lacerations or hematomas. Tissue, which is like retained tissue or invasive placenta, which is what we're talking about now. And then thrombin, so coagulopathy. And for the mainstay of what you'll experience in your IACOA and in most obstetric patients is you've got a problem with tone. And so you will give a uterotonic. Interestingly, with patients who have an abnormal placenta, giving a uterotonic can sometimes make bleeding worse because there might be a plan to leave the placenta in situ and not let it separate. Whereas when we give those uterotonics, they cause the placenta to separate and the uterus to contract. So that would be something that you would discuss in your MDT plan at the beginning. And you would say, what's the plan for the placenta? Are we trying to remove it? Are we leaving it in? What are we doing for uterotonics? So you don't tend to give them prophylactically, but you might give them if you then encounter bleeding.
What about TXA? Would you use that in these patients?
Tranexamic acid is well demonstrated benefits in the situation of PPH, so we would definitely give it to manage obstetric hemorrhage. We probably wouldn't give it prophylactically because it's not well studied in PAS, but as part of a major hemorrhage protocol, yes, tranexamic acid can definitely be useful.
And that's in spite of their increased VT risk?
Yeah.
Okay.
Post-op, probably going to be a HDU or an ITU scenario, depending on how unwell they are, because you want to monitor them for ongoing bleeding. They can potentially have fluid overload if they've had a massive transfusion. And there is a risk of multi-organ dysfunction, which you'd want to be able to pick up. Probably have a debrief. And then you've got your VT prophylaxis that you're thinking about. So that's a bit more complicated in this because you've got to balance that risk of ongoing bleeding. Mm. Sometimes they've got vascular occlusion devices in situ. And also if they've got an epidural still in, that might lead to some difficulties with timing, which they might have the epidural still in because they do tend to have higher pain requirements because their surgery has been more complicated. That can be a little bit tricky, but that's why a high dependency area is much more appropriate for them post-op.
So in summary, they're very complicated patients that need MDT input. And if there's not that, then senior input very early and have a contingency plan of how you're going to manage the inevitable bleeding that is likely with these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is definitely, you know, somebody who should have been seen in anaesthetic high-risk clinic and have a detailed plan. And it just highlights the importance to us of always thinking about the obstetric side of things. So look at the scan, look at where the placenta is. Hopefully they've had ultrasound imaging. Just check that you're happy with that and the obstetric team are happy with that.
And these are sometimes patients where there's a to be aware of on the obs boards. That proactive approach with these patients is why we're doing this episode, right? You want to not be hiding away from those abnormal placentas, right?
That's what I do every day.
That's what you do every day.
Attention anaesthetists. Are you looking for a more efficient way to manage your medical rotas and clinical allocations? Are you on a hospital rota and wish it was easier and quicker to manage your own shifts? Introducing Hospital, the rostering platform designed by anaesthetists for medical professionals like you. With Hospital, you can track your shifts, manage leave, and make changes. As an administrator, you can significantly reduce the effort to build rosters and keep them up to date, all in real time, from any device. It's seamless, reliable, and tailored to the unique demands of medical teams. With 15 years of experience in anaesthesia in Australia and suitable for hospitals all over the world, Hospital streamlines your work so you can focus on providing exceptional care. Join thousands of healthcare professionals who trust Hospital to simplify their scheduling. Visit hosportal.com today to learn more and arrange a demonstration. That's hosportal.com. Hosportal, professional scheduling made simple.
Oh, Owen, you're back. Did you have a nice tea break?
Oh, it was lovely, actually. Did you have fun?
Yeah, we've been managing very complicated tertiary centre patient, actually.
Oh, that's good. That's normally what I think you should do on your first day.
But I'm glad you're back, actually, because Rosie's disappeared and I've been called to room one, which is a 41-year-old lady who's had one previous baby. This is an IVF pregnancy, and she's also got background in diabetes, and there's an acronym PET on the board. I don't know what that is.
She's got lots of pets with her. It's yeah. part of her birth plan.
Oh, I'd love that.
Yeah. Imagine that 5% of people in the UK have a plan to bring in their pet puppy or cat. No, it does not stand for that.
It could be an emotional support dog.
Or hamster. And
this tertiary zoo that you've now created in the imaginary world is not that. It's a term for preeclampsia. So this is a hypertensive spectrum disorder of pregnancy.
Why is it not just called that? Why is it called eclampsia?
Oh, interesting. Eclampsia comes from the Greek word of lightning strike, which occurs with eclamptic seizures, which are usually quick onset and offset type seizures for 1 to 2 minutes. But there is a whole spectrum of disease before that. So preeclampsia, this is the umbrella term of hypertensive disease in pregnancy. Okay, so 5% of women will get diagnosed with preeclampsia, and there's a few different things to think about. So women might have hypertension before 20 weeks. They might have pregnancy-induced hypertension, which is hypertensive disease greater than 140 over 90 without any of the preeclampsia signs, or they might have preeclampsia, which is new onset hypertension after 20 weeks with systolic of 140, diastolic greater than 90, and then touching on one or more of these three zones: protein, maternal organ dysfunction, or uteroplacental organ dysfunction, right? So protein is because we can't run around after pregnant women trying to get 24 urinary hours samples. We have to do a urine protein creatinine ratio, which is greater than 30. Maternal organ dysfunction covers a whole spectrum of things, but that can be AKI, can be stroke or epilepsy, can be the creatinine going up, it could be pulmonary edema, shortness of breath, epigastric pain. There's a whole list of criteria. You can read about them and pick them up at another time. Just know that those are the things that we're sort of looking at. And then the interesting category that we probably wouldn't have thought about before is uterine placental flow. This is to do with an impaired placenta implantation. Okay, I'll get onto that in a sec, but they look at things such as the uterine arterial Dopplers. They look at things like in uterine growth retardation. It's a sort of a spectrum of disease, if that makes sense. And there's a few different headings that you'll have with hypertension. And when I go in and I see someone who's newly hypertensive, I do like to start asking these questions. Have we done the protein? Have we sent a PCR? What is it? What are the other blood tests? Because you want to start building up. It's not a case of someone's got a PET on the board. Okay, that's one thing. This is a whole spectrum. And these can be some of the sickest patients in the hospital as well.
Sorry, this might be a silly question, but are women not likely to be hypertensive when they're in pain and anxious? And how do you decide when it's pathological?
That is a really good question. So what is high blood pressure? What would put my blood pressure up? I think trying to squeeze a baby out would probably do it from both my empathy and my sympathy point of views. They define pregnancy-induced hypertension as 140 over 90, greater than 3 hours readings apart. Okay, and that should be taken when the patient's not having an ongoing contraction, because also they'll be tensing their upper arms and things like that.
More of like an ongoing trend rather than like isolated.
And PET's not something that just goes once it's resolved with preeclampsia. It's a condition that leaves the mother with an increased risk of long-term health conditions such as hypertension, which you might guess, and an increased risk of cardiovascular, neurological disorders, diabetes, and even reoccurring if it comes on to the next pregnancy.
Okay, so it sounds pretty serious.
This is someone who I would actually put my cup of tea down just to listen before I took a sip.
We should have been like sponsored by any tea brands available.
Why does this happen and why do we not see it in non-pregnant people?
Well, thank you for that lovely question. And I actually read something called the textbook in order to answer this. This is all to do with a disease of how the placenta embeds its blood supply into the maternal circulation. Okay, so between the maternal circulation and the fetus will be a spiral artery. And if they don't implant correctly and cause dilatation of those arteries that will link up to the maternal supply, causes hypoperfusion, so not enough blood going to that placental unit, and then it releases something called cytokines, which apparently are proteins that cause signaling, who knew, and that causes inflammatory mediators to be released. I'm not sure they cause relaxation. This causes widespread endothelial dysfunction, so cells get a little bit leaky, vasoconstriction, so starts affecting your systemic cardiovascular system. It can cause activation of the clotting cascade. All of this leads to a systemic reaction for the fetus not getting enough blood supply due to it not embedding correctly. So the people who are at risk of that are people who would be at risk of having poor blood supply. So that's chronic hypertensives, diabetics, chronic kidney disease, people with autoimmune conditions, people who have previously had preeclampsia, and then you've got lesser risks, which is increasing maternal age over 40, if it's the first time they've had a baby, also known as a primate. Good. Greater than 10 years between pregnancy, BMI over 35, if they're a teenager, if they have IVF. You can imagine it's all from this embedding of the and dilatation of the spiral arteries. If you then think about the people who would have worse blood supply than other mothers, then that would be the risks. Does that all make sense?
Yes.
And you haven't gone to sleep yet due to that. And I have talked about pathophysiology, so I'm really impressed.
You even said the word cytokine. Cytokine?
Professor Dorr.
I got through my whole OSCE and VIVAs without even having to mention the word cytokine.
So why mention it now?
But I'm so glad it didn't come up. They would have seen 2 minutes of real water treading there.
So you told me the pathophysiology, but how will they present? Like, what are the clinical features of this going to be?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So we said that happens after 20 weeks, and we also said it's to do with blood flow. So they could present from 20 weeks onwards, and they could present symptomatically or asymptomatically. Asymptomatically is the easiest one to say. So that's where they notice that they have high blood pressure. They either do tests on the blood tests that show disorders of organ dysfunction, or they show that the blood supply to the fetus is really impaired, or they notice that there's protein in the urine association and get diagnosed like that. However, others have a spectrum that occur from anything from the neuro, which could be things like headaches, visual changes, they're at risk of intracranial bleeds, and then they can lead on to seizures, as we mentioned at the start of this, with the and then they've also got, with endothelial dysfunction, they've got things that affect their cardiovascular system. So they can have hypertension, they can be very leaky due to a loss of protein, which actually weirdly leaves them intravascularly deplete, but also very highly disposed to pulmonary edema due to the fact they've got such leaky endothelial. And they can have an effect on their heart due to all these inflammatory mediators that get released that cause diastolic dysfunction of their heart. Also, they can have renal impairment, doubling of their creatinine. They can have effects on their clotting system, hemolysis, decreased platelets, some DIC, and they can get something called HELLP syndrome, which is really severe preeclampsia, where you have hemolysis with your increase in your LDH, elevated liver enzymes, and decreased platelets. So it can affect every part of the body.
Everything you can think of.
Yeah, yeah. And you actually look quite terrified. Sorry about that.
So I guess if it's a spectrum, the hardest thing is often making a decision, right, of when you need to intervene with something. And so where along that spectrum would you then, there'd be like a red flag for you?
What makes my ears prick up when I'm listening to the Labour Board, people get classed as severe if they have a blood pressure over 160 systolic or 110 diastolic, if they've got renal dysfunction, liver dysfunction, low platelets, if they seize, seems fairly obvious, right? If they get pulmonary edema, which up to 10% of people with severe preeclampsia can do, and if they have something on the uterine arteries known as end-diastolic reverse flow, showing what a degree of vasoconstriction is going on in the spiral arteries, those are tending towards people that I'm thinking, okay, this person's high risk, they could be developing HELLP, these might be someone, and we'll get onto later, that might need more routine blood tests, or I need to know what the latest platelets is, because if we are going to theatre and you've got someone with a disorder that drops their platelets and they're clotting, you're going to want to know before you stick a needle in the back what it is.
So going back to the lady in room one, you said that this is a condition you'd put your tea down for. I've come to tell you about her.
But we said a spectrum, so it's a spectrum of like tea putting down, so put down right
it's
away.
It's not a free pass.
Yeah, it's
help.
Not a free pass, yeah.
Okay, so let's imagine that this lady might be severe. We don't know yet.
Mm-hmm.
I've come to tell you about her preemptively. What goals would you have in mind of what you need to be considering to avoid any disasters?
It's a good thought. So it's obviously you want to go and define the problem, see where the severe aspects are. In terms of her management, when she comes in and she's in labour, you want to think about her fluid management, because you won't want to overload her. We've already said they're more leaking, which needs to be weighed up against the fact that they could be intravascularly deplete. Concentrated infusions for things such as oxytocin. You're going to want to control the blood pressure, which I probably should have started off with first, right? And you aim for less than 135 over 85, and I'll go over some of their agents. You'll need to think about what you would do for your seizures and whether or not you start them on seizure prophylaxis, which is quite important. And then you also want to think about the fetus, because one of the treatments for preeclampsia is actually the delivery of the fetus, but that needs to be weighed up with the fetal health and when that's timing of things such as steroids, and what the overall plan I'm getting onto from obstetrics is whether or not they're going to induce or whether or not they're going to deliver a via cesarean section. Mm-hmm. And all of this is whilst looking at a pathology that could be getting worse at the time. So you need to have up-to-date bloods, which each department have different guidelines, but you will want to, in severe preeclampsias, have a platelets at least within 6 hours.
Okay. And so you mentioned that they might deliver via C-section. Is there any other considerations for these patients when you're preparing them for theatre?
There is, and I think there's some central things to think about. Firstly, is controlling the blood pressure. They're an increased risk of intracerebral hemorrhage, and you don't want to do interventions when they will have a systolic of 250, for example. You've got to think about their fluid management, as we said, that 1 mL/kg, but they're also intravascularly deplete, so that will need to be very carefully thought about. You need to think about what you'll do for seizure prophylaxis. They're at increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage, right? We've already said you've got someone with coagulopathy with maybe decreased platelets who's got an increased blood pressure. What are you going to do about that? Do not use non-steroidals. Brilliant. Think about their VT prophylaxis. They're still at higher risk of clot afterwards. Do not use ergometrin. That's again another no-no for them, okay?
Can you do the button?
There we are, I'm buttoning some.
Why not ergometrin?
Ergometrin is a ergot derivative that drives up blood pressure as well.
Oh, fine, okay, yeah. So obviously not ergometrin.
So you've got neuraxial versus GA. You would likely want to advocate more for a neuraxial, and that's benefits for blood pressure management and cardiovascular stability. You need to balance the risks associated with them. We've said their coagulopathy, their platelets can go down. There are good rules that should be in your department, or you can use the association's regional anesthesia guideline for whether or not you do a spinal or not and how long that blood test needs to be.
What we were saying about anticipating problems on the labour ward, if you've got somebody on there who you've been seeing because they're preeclamptic, they then develop a symptom or whatever and you decide they're now severe, it's a good point, even if the delivery isn't imminent, to say, we need to make sure that this person's got 6 hourly platelets, so can we repeat that now? So it's like having that foresight of,
yeah,
okay, something's changed now, let's just anticipate.
During an anaesthetic, they're at real risk of a hypertensive response to laryngoscopy that could lead to intracerebral bleeding. So you need to firstly abate that with an opioid, or by not doing a GA, doing a regional. You may need a smaller endotracheal tube. They get significant edema due to the fact that they've got lower oncotic pressure. Mm. That edema is not just localized to their hands, it goes into their vocal cords, okay? Mm. So you need to prepare for a potentially more difficult airway, and it might be more friable as well. The extubation is also a hypertensive response, so working out what you're going to do to abate that as well. And as I've mentioned before, they're intravascularly deplete. Their blood pressure can really go down during a... And you need to be very careful about that.
No, it's too high,
yeah,
it's too low.
It's because they're so vasoconstricted that then when you give them something, they can really drop quite quickly. And they're also very, very sensitive to vasopressor agents.
So, Serena, you looked even more shocked than when we normally do intensive care nights together. So, thoughts about that? Are you terrified or is it better to know?
Yeah, I think it's definitely better to know because I spend half my time worrying about what I don't know. Being a bit more informed does help with the anxiety, but also knowing how much can go wrong.
I think preeclampsia is one of the like bread and butter things of labour ward. Like if you are not at all interested in OBS and you just want to like know a few key things, preeclampsia is one of the ones that you'll come across really frequently. And there are only a couple of things for management. So yeah, it's definitely one to read around and get a bit more comfortable with.
They will be on different therapies, and that's why saying, oh, they're on therapy, what's that even mean? Because they can be on IV therapy, they could be on oral. So there's four agents that you can give. Most commonly, first line is labetalol, which can be given orally or IV, and that's a alpha and beta receptor blocker. And you use that caution with asthmatics and diabetics as well. Nifedipine blocks calcium. It's given orally only, and that can also cause supreme vasodilatation in people who are also given magnesium, so be aware. Methyldopa is a centrally acting alpha drug for alpha 2. It is only given orally again, and it can be linked to postnatal depression. Hydralazine is a direct acting vasodilator, and that's only given IV, and that can cause a really bad reflex tachycardia, so you need to be aware of that. When you're talking about the scale of things, saying that, oh, she's on the labetalol, well, she might only be on 200, which is the once a day, which is standard dose, or she could be on an IV infusion where they're also thinking about bolusing some further agents. So that gives a different picture to the person you're speaking up to the end of the phone, because then they're thinking, if that blood pressure is like that, well, that's systemic. What are the platelets, what are the coagulation, how difficult is this lady going to be providing an anaesthetic intervention for?
Paints a picture. This lady's been managed in theatre. She's had a baby. She's back in room one. We're about to go off for a tea break, and then there's an emergency buzzer. Someone's running around talking about a seizure. I thought we'd fixed her. She's had the baby.
The only definitive treatment for preeclampsia is delivery of the fetoplacental unit. But even once you've done that, there can still be seizures that present postnatally. So it's important to keep it in the back of your mind.
Yeah, really good point, Rosie. And when you're approaching that, buzzer pull's gone off, you still need to follow the basics, okay? There's a QRH plan for eclampsia. You do your A2E with the lady in the recovery position, and you keep in mind a broad differential. Not all seizures are going to be eclampsia. You've got to think about glucose. We talked about intracranial bleeds. And then you've got some treatment things, okay? So you've got magnesium, which will be new for you to use. Boluses versus infusion. You've got to think about controlling the BP. I'm not going to go more into that. Just know that that's a thought. And then you've got to think about whether or not this person needs a rapid CT to rule out those other things. Now, you might say, magnesium, that's interesting. Why don't we use that everywhere? Well, magnesium is a wonder drug, and it gets used here due to a couple of trials. So there was the MAGPIE trial, which had about 5,000 people on each arm, which showed that it reduced seizures in half of people in comparison to placebo. And then there's also been comparisons between magnesium, phenytoin, and benzos, which has shown that magnesium for preeclampsia is the better drug to use. And we give a bolus of about 4 grams over 5 minutes, and then there's different infusions they can go on afterwards. People can get magnesia toxic. You have dysarthria, confusion, loss of deep tendon reflexes, and then changes in the ECG. And what you need to know is magnesium is excreted renally, so you pee it out, but we also have a condition that affects your kidneys, right? So you need to be monitoring to make sure they've got greater than half a mil per kilogram per hour, because if that's decreasing, we need to change our magnesium dose, otherwise they're going to build up. And the treatment for it is calcium gluconate, and that's in the OBS QRH. So that feels like a whistle-stop tour of preeclampsia. Both put fear and knowledge in, which is good.
It'll guide some further reading.
Serena, we've got another patient for you to review. They're in room 6.
Yeah, I can see that. So 32, Gravida 3, Para 2, GDM, BM tick.
Okay, so we've got GDM that we're looking at. What are our important things for gestational diabetes in pregnancy to know about, if you were to have a minute, Rosie?
Whistle stop tour. Okay, so I think GDM's one of the things you'll see commonly written on the Labour War Board. Gestational diabetes is the most common type of diabetes that we see in pregnancy, followed by type 1 diabetes, followed by type 2 diabetes. It's increasing in prevalence, and these women do have a higher risk of perinatal morbidity. So macrosomial, having a big baby, birth injuries, premature delivery. And they've got a higher risk of cesarean section and complications such as sepsis and PET. So you might see them all together. Our main goals are to basically keep the glucose normal, so avoid maternal hypo or hyperglycemia. Think about the safe use of things like variable rate insulin infusions, and also to just provide them with effective analgesia for labour, because as we've already said, we're a bit more likely to encounter them and maybe need to carry out interventions. So handy if they've already got an epidural in situ, for example. The reason why we want to control the glucose is because if the mother is hyperglycemic, that actually causes the pancreatic beta cells in the fetus to multiply, and they have increased fetal insulin concentration circulating around, which is fine while they're in utero. And then when they're delivered, they can be quite severely hypoglycemic, which is obviously really dangerous. And there are a couple of guidelines for what we want to do for monitoring these women. So we should be measuring a capillary blood glucose hourly intrapartum. And the target is quite tight. It's 4 to 7. Apart from if they're intraoperative, if they're having operative delivery in theatre, they relax it very slightly to 5 to 8. So you know, I'll have a whole extra one.
Yeah. So generous.
I know. And if you find that you're not meeting those targets, then you can start a variable rate insulin infusion with a glucose containing fluid run alongside the IV insulin. But again, with everything we do in medicine, there's a potential for errors, right? So errors with the prescriptions. We do just need to be aware of that's why there's that slightly more lenient intra-op target. Otherwise, we'd be giving everyone variable rate infusions. If the patient already has like a clever insulin pump or something like that, and that's working great, then that's fine. You can carry on with that. But if it's not, then you can turn it off and switch it to a variable rate insulin infusion. You'll have your own guidelines for this, but it's important to remember to continue the long-acting insulin. Mm. We have to just be mindful that we know that pregnant women are at a higher risk of hyponatremia. And if they're having IV glucose and they're having oxytocin infusions, that can be additive. So we just need to monitor their sodiums and make sure that we're not making them too hyponatremic. They have a higher chance of anaesthetic intervention, but if we do encounter them, we can actually make quite a nice difference to their labour. If we can give them an epidural, we can reduce their risk of needing a GA. We should make sure that we're looking out for hypoglycemia and treating that promptly with some 20% dextrose. If you did need to give them a GA, then you have to do their BM half hourly, double the frequency. Mm. Postpartum-wise, actually, their requirements for insulin go right down. There are a couple of different guidelines of what to do about that. That's definitely one to read in your local policy. That's the summary. It wasn't very summarised.
Well, we're pre-lunch, so my blood sugar's going low.
My blood sugar's too.
Blood's going high.
No, I think that was a good snapshot.
Brilliant. Anything else you'd like a snapshot on, Serena, before we break off for lunch? We've dealt with obesity, PET. We've dealt with some placentas being in different places. Anything else you'd like to know about?
There is one organ that's quite vital and can sometimes have complications. And so the combination of obstetric patient and cardiac patient is quite anxiety-inducing.
Oh, no. It makes me feel anxious.
There's a lot of conditions and we don't have time to cover it all. But is there any kind of general principles of monitoring or kind of managing a cardiac obstetric patient or any kind of specific things to consider?
Firstly, you should know that the impact on morbidity and mortality is high. The EMBRACE, the most recent one that was released in 23, demonstrated that it's a high cause of maternal mortality. So we need to know what we're doing, so to speak, and that there is some physiology that is prevalent during labour. Every time you have a contraction, you get 500 mils auto transfusion. If you've got a heart that is just about in keeping with the maternal physiology of your blood's volume increasing by 50% throughout the entire course of labour, that's quite a big pressure to put it under. And then just because you've had the baby doesn't mean you're out of the dangerous just yet. In the remaining 1 to 3 days postpartum, they can have about 50% of their blood volume return as the mother starts to go into its perinatal period. There's a lot of physiological changes. We know from data that it affects and has poor outcomes. What are the conditions you need to know about? Well, we're having more people survive with congenital heart conditions. We're having more comorbid people come forward, and there's a risk of ischemic heart disease and arrhythmias. And I think you just need to have a good plan when it comes to it. And these are people who should be dealt with by MDT in a sensible location. That's not saying that's always the case. With an early epidural. I think we were hearing Rosie's PTSD probably coming out there with that laugh.
I'm sounding pretty nervous.
Someone to escalate early to your senior reg and your obstetric anaesthetic and know what the plan is going to be. And as I've mentioned with the physiological changes, the plan should be to try and abate those, essentially. That's not really touching upon anything of use, but it's just saying that be aware of it, involve other people earlier on, and think about, again, the same with the obesity, how you can ablate some of the physiological stresses of labour.
So that's why you do the early epidural, right? To try and help manage some of that.
Yeah, because one of the physiological changes I didn't talk about is the catecholamine sympathetic drive that is caused by pain and the increase in heart rate, obviously, that it causes. That's less diastolic filling time. There's lots of changes that can occur to the, or pressures that can put on the heart there.
There are some very good BJA articles on pregnant women with congenital heart disease, arrhythmias, and pulmonary hypertension, which if you do develop an interest in OBS and you want to look at, like, after the IACOA, they're very good.
I think we've covered a huge array of pathophysiology. Mm. I've had to read 2 different textbooks or Wikipedia articles, can't remember which was which.
Just to know what a cytokine is.
Just know what a cytokine was. I don't know if that's made you more sweaty about coming onto the OBS room, less sweaty, more calm. I don't know. How are you feeling after this episode?
It's definitely been a lot of information, but I think half the time as a junior, you worry about when and when you should and shouldn't be asking for help. Mm. And so hearing about how complex these conditions can be has actually reassured me that they often need senior input or a previous MDT plan. And so that in itself is reassuring.
That is the best takeaway that we could have said. You have got people who could become easily the sickest patients in the hospital within a couple of hours as the labour is progressing, and knowing who to call and when to call it and having that lower threshold than you would have done when you're on the other theatres is really important.
The other thing I just wanted to say was you said something at the beginning of the episode about having to frantically Google stuff, and I actually would encourage you to Google everything. I think starting on OBS can be really overwhelming when you don't actually know what these obstetric things are. So one of the things when I first started, there was something on the board that said vasoprevia. And everyone was talking about it, and I couldn't remember from medical school what that was.
Mm.
And it feels so silly to say that, but just look up everything. Look up all the obstetrics. Go on the ward round. Ask them the questions. Say, why do you do this and not this, or why are you worried about that? Because you will find that it massively helps you.
Yeah, 100%.
And with that, it's pathophysiology out. Hello and welcome to the outro. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. I certainly enjoyed re-listening to it. As ever, we have some good links for you to have a look at. Firstly, the one we should lead off with is the obstetric QRH, of which the clinical lead for this podcast series, Kirsty McCallan, was one of the lead authors. We also have the e-learning for healthcare modules. We also have another online training platform to have a look at, along with some BJA articles, including ones on maternal cardiac disease and some important trials to have a look at, including the MAGPIE trial. One thing that's important to note is that ladies of higher BMI are more likely to have larger babies, and thus they may be more at risk of obstructed labour, shoulder dystocia, and delivery-induced trauma, creating a PPH risk. You may have to have 2 listens to this episode, as there is a lot of content in it, but I promise you it's all there to help push you up that learning curve of obstetric anaesthetics. As ever, please do like and share with friends and colleagues if you found this episode useful,
and we'll see you at the next one, where Rosie and I are joined by Gail, a senior midwife coordinator in the busy London hospital, who will talk about how Labour Ward looks after the maternal and fetal well-being. So I look forward to seeing you there. Bye for now.